Well, we have just about wrapped up our study of church history in what's commonly known as the European Middle Ages. Recent episodes looked at the Crusades, some of the largest and most influential monastic orders, and in the last episode, we considered the fascinating tale of Rabban Sama, who lived a truly epic life. And we're going to be spending a bit longer in the Middle Ages before shifting into the setup for the Renaissance and the Reformation. And we have several themes and topics to develop. It's going to take a few episodes to do so. And the first that we're going to look at, because it ends up being a recurring problem, is what's called the investiture controversy. This was a theological and political dust-up that came about as a result of the fusion of church and state in feudal Europe. Church officials often had both religious and secular roles. Though they weren't part of the official nobility, they did hold positions in the ultra-strict social structure of the feudal system. Serfs didn't just work the lands of the nobility, many of them worked church lands and church holdings. Now, some bishops and abbots not only oversaw their ecclesiastical duties, they were secular rulers as well. So you can imagine how these clerics were torn in their loyalty between the Pope and far-off Rome and the much closer feudal duke or earl, count, baron, to say nothing of the emerging kings of Europe. As we've seen in earlier episodes, when the Roman Empire dissolved in the West, the role and responsibility of civil government often fell to church officials. Most people wanted them to step in. So when feudalism took hold, it wasn't a difficult transition for these religious leaders to be invested with the duties of secular rule. Now, because bishops, abbots, and other church officials had secular as well as spiritual authority, many of Europe's nobility began to take it upon themselves to appoint those bishops and abbots when vacancies occurred. It's not difficult to see why they'd want to, instead of waiting on Rome to make the selection. It might take months, even years, to appoint a new bishop. Meanwhile, there were important decisions to be made today. And while Rome would pick someone whose primary concern was, well, Rome, local rulers wanted someone running things amiable to their aims. Also, inheritance rules, the way they were, with everything going to the firstborn son, a lucrative and influential career as a bishop, well, that was a plum job for all of those second and third sons. This investing of church offices by secular rulers was called lay investiture, because it was done by the laity, rather than by ordained clergy. And as you can imagine, it was not something the popes were real happy about. Though the details are different today, imagine you're a church member for 30 years. One day your pastor says that he's retiring, and you expect your denomination or maybe the elders of your church to pick the new pastor. So how surprised would you be to find out that the local mayor is going to pick your pastor? Oh, and by the way, if you squawk about it, well, the police will arrest you and toss you in jail till you learn to shut your yap and go along with the new arrangement. Well, welcome to lay investiture. While the Roman church mostly opposed this investiture, because administrating the church all over Europe was a monumental task, for centuries the popes have begrudgingly allowed secular rulers to assist in the appointment of local church officials. Some of these appointments were wise, provided good and godly men to lead the church in their domain. But other times, nepotism and crass pragmatism saw, at the best, inept, and at the worst, corrupt officials installed. Lay investiture became a controversy when popes decided to rein things in and required that church officials be appointed by the church itself. Secular rulers were no longer allowed to do so. But just because popes said no to lay investiture didn't mean secular rulers stopped doing it. And that's where the whole thing became a controversy. It came to a head in 1076 when Pope Gregory VII and the Holy Roman Emperor Henry IV came to a loggerhead over the Archbishop of Milan. Both men proposed different candidates, and both believed it was his right to appoint the office. Pope Gregory threatened excommunication if Emperor Henry refused to comply. Henry answered by calling a synod of German bishops at Worms in 1076. The synod deposed Pope Gregory. Not to be outdone, Gregory excommunicated Henry and absolved all of his subjects of allegiance to him. A deft move, since at the time Henry and his Saxon nobles were at odds. Those nobles demanded that Henry reconcile with Gregory within a year or forfeit his throne. Now, the emperor was forced to make peace with the pope in a famous meeting at Canossa. Henry demonstrated his contrition by walking around the castle barefoot for 3 days in the snow. The Pope reversed the excommunication and received the emperor back into the faith. And that's the end of the story. Happy one, right? Nah, not quite. Henry leveraged his return to favor into a campaign against the Pope. He marched on Rome and set up a new Pope. Gregory died in exile. Still, Pope Gregory's position on investiture eventually prevailed. In 1099, Pope Urban II decreed that anyone who either gave or received lay investiture was excommunicated. Then in 1105, a moderate compromise was reached at Bec and ratified in the Council at Westminster 2 years later. Holy Roman Emperor Henry IV was followed by Emperor Henry, can you guess it? Yeah, Henry V. See, you're catching on to this whole historical gig. Well, pretty soon you'll be doing your own podcasts. Okay, it was during Henry V's reign that the papacy ultimately won the investiture struggle. At Worms in 1122, a concordat was drawn up in which the emperor agreed that the church should elect bishops and abbots and invest them with their office. Although elections were to be held in the presence of the king, he was prohibited from influencing the decision by simony or the threat of violence. While it was the church who selected her clergy, it was the secular rulers who then handed them the symbols of their authority in the form of a crozier and a ring, representing their role as the shepherd of God's flock and that they were married to the church. By allowing secular rulers a hand in the bestowal of these symbols of their office, it conveyed the idea of the bishop's duty to support the secular ruler. And the political intrigues that flowed from this dual loyalty of church officials across Europe is a thing of legend, literally. I'm guessing many of you have seen at least one movie that captures the intrigues that ruled the political and religious scene at that time. Despite the Concordat of Worms in 1122, there were a few of Europe's nobles who continued to practice lay investiture. And there were plenty of their appointees willing to go along with them because they were being appointed to some pretty cushy posts. But eventually, lay investiture was set aside as feudal society gave way to the modern world. The controversy over lay investiture signals the emerging tension that existed in medieval Europe between church and state. One of the defining elements of the Middle Ages is the close association between altars and thrones. There was a synergism between church and state that makes what we call the Middle Ages the Middle Ages. But as Europe's nobles consolidated their wealth and their influence, that synergism morphed into a competition for land and power. Some of the nobles evolved into kings who wanted more power, more wealth, more influence. And since there seemed to be only so much of it to go around, they went after it wherever it was concentrated. And that was in the position of bishops who opened and closed the doors of heaven. The controversy over lay investiture was a major part of setting the stage for the Renaissance in the modern world by helping divide church and state from the union that had marked the medieval world. We're going to round out this episode with a review of an aberrant doctrine that kept resurfacing in the church of both the East and the West. It was an attempt to understand the person of Christ. Now, anyone who takes their grasp of church history beyond the basics will run into a heresy that kept surfacing. It was called adoptionism. Adoptionism had an early origin, being advocated by the Ebionites in the 2nd century. The famous Gnostic heresiarch, Cerinthus, taught a form of it. While the details of adoptionism vary from time to time and place to place, the basic idea is that Jesus was merely a human who was adopted by God into his role as Messiah and Savior. Now, the nature of this adoption, that is, what it affected in Jesus, is where adoptionists differ. That and when exactly God the Father adopted Jesus, the man, to become the Son of God. Now, some think that it occurred at his baptism, others at his resurrection, still others at his ascension. Adoptionists all concur with Jesus' humanity, but deny his eternal essence as God the Son. They say he became the Son of God due to his morally excellent life. Now, the church declared adoptionism a heresy at the end of the 2nd century, but it continued to find a home in the work of several teachers and groups in the following centuries, right up through the Middle Ages and even into some groups today. The entire camp of what's called New Thought holds this view, as well as some progressive Christians. The term adoptionism is used to describe another, but well, really different flavor of the idea that arose in Spain during the 8th and the 9th century. And so it's called, creatively enough, Spanish adoptionism. It might be better to call it reverse adoptionism because it starts with God the Son, who adopts a human body, but not a human nature. Confused? Let me explain it this way. Right now, there's a new movie out on the life of the famous musician Bob Dylan called A Complete Unknown. The actor Timothée Chalamet is reported to do a fantastic job of portraying Dylan. I haven't seen the movie yet, but that's what I've heard. He's not Bob Dylan. He's playing a part. He looks like Dylan, sounds like Dylan, moves and acts like Dylan. But he's in fact the actor Timothée Chalamet stepping into the role of Bob Dylan. That's an illustration of Spanish adoptionism, which said that God, the Son, pretended to be a man in the incarnation. Now, the first to articulate this view was in the late 8th century, Elipandus. He was the Archbishop of Toledo. His views were quickly seized on by his opponents and declared heretical. His supporters were summoned to appear before the Holy Roman Emperor Charlemagne, whose clerics were able to persuade them away from their aberrant beliefs. Now, that ought to have been the end of the matter. They'd been treated civilly and with respect by the emperor. But when they arrived before the Pope in Rome, they were publicly humiliated. And this seems to have only inflamed the adherents back in Spain, who determined to resist Rome's efforts to rein them in. Now, this came at an unfortunate moment, because the church in Spain was at that time dealing with the Moorish Muslim rulers. While adoptionism can rightly be labeled a heresy, especially its early manifestation, Spanish adoptionism, it's a trickier wicket. I don't want to get into the technical details of the theology, so let me just say that there are in the New Testament some passages that at a surface reading seem to speak of Jesus with two sonships. When those passages are viewed through the lens of some of the early church fathers, one can see a subtle nod towards the core ideas of Spanish adoptionism. And it gets back to something that we've spoken often of here, how to understand and then to articulate the nature, person, and identity of Jesus. Theology is the fine art of making distinctions, and those distinctions are expressed in words. Finding the exact right word has proven to be the angst-filled work of centuries and some of the keenest minds in history. Though Spanish adoptionism was effectively quelled by the 10th century, it resurfaced in the 11th and the 12th to once again enjoy a brief moment in the sun, and then to be sprayed with some more theological roundup and die out once more. It's the ancient classical adoptionism that's enjoyed a resurgence in modern times in the flavor of new thought that fueled liberal Christianity. In this brand of adoptionism, Jesus is a man who by his exemplary moral path becomes an enlightened agent for God's Spirit to work through. This liberal progressive Jesus isn't a savior so much as an example, a pathfinder who doesn't make a way for us to heaven so much as just show us the way there. Obviously, not the historic position of the Orthodox Christian Church.